This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
The tenor saxophone of John Ellis leads us into our live program today. We're talking with David Crowley from Alton, Illinois, about various books, particularly Christian theology books. We'll start with that at least. Welcome, David. We're talking to you by phone. Can you hear me okay?
Oh, yes, Steve. It's a pleasure to hear your voice and a privilege to be on your show.
Well, great. Well, let's just jump right into this. Now, you come from a long line of distinguished universities, University of Maryland, University of North Carolina, Princeton Seminary. Did you like to read before you went to all those high-powered places?
Oh, sure. I was so naive that when I went to Maryland, I couldn't understand how the library wasn't packed with people wanting to get their hands on all the magazines that were there. But I probably never read a book on serious religion until I was probably, oh goodness, in my mid-20s. I read pretty much history and government books and some science books when I was a kid.
Now, you were focusing on political science for much of your career and were sort of a late entry into seminary. When did you feel the call to be a minister?
Oh, I'll give you the short form of a long story. I did a lot of work when I was teaching at Augustana College with a wonderful campus pastor there named Phil Schrader, and we worked on a lot of church and state and public policy and ethics programs for the campus ministry. And over time, I started getting more interested in the religion part than the politics part. And at the same time, I had been a pre-law advisor and was really dealing with a lot of values questions with young people and questions of vocation, even though I didn't have that language back then, and was finding myself being unwillingly called into the ministry. And I got to the point where I was going to go to Dubuque Seminary part-time and try to keep teaching, but so Jonah is my biblical hero of trying to run. And I knew that I wouldn't find ease or peace until I gave in and went to seminary. And by that time, I joined the Presbyterian Church, and my pastor said that Princeton was where I should go. And rightly or wrongly, off I went and then became a pastor after that.
Let's jump into talking about books. One of the books that you recommended to a study group that I'm a part of that meets every 6 months or so was by a Canadian Christian theologian named Douglas John Hall. The book was Why Christian? For Those on the Edge of Faith. Questions for Those on the Edge of Faith. Why Christian? Why did you pick that book to recommend to that particular group of pastors and professors of religion and so on?
My memory probably isn't as good as yours, but when we were struggling for the next book to look at, someone brought up apologetics. How do Christians speak to critics or friends of the faith and try to write a defense of where the Christian church is in a particular point in time? And Douglas John Hall has always been sort of my guy since seminary, and I thought that his book would fit our group because he's a good writer, he's very bright, but that I thought he would fit us in that he criticizes the hardcore conservative wing of the church, but he's also willing to criticize the more liberal wing of the church. And he creates this young student who's a composite, who's his interlocutor throughout. And the way he begins the book itself, I like. He says that the people he's talking to, and he says he always writes with a face in mind, could be anyone, a working person, a young professional, a middle-aged parent, or a grandparent like myself, really almost anyone. And then he said, someone wrote him a letter and said, I've always felt drawn to God and to the hope that life has meaning, but I struggle with it. There's so much suffering and evil in the world, and belief in a good God is not an easy thing for anyone who thinks to a significant degree. And then Hall goes, it's that kind of doubting faith, or faithful doubt with which I want to dialogue here. I think I understand. It's where I live, too, most of the time. And I think that's where a lot of the people in our group, Reform Roundtable, may well live a lot of the time, in a thinking faith that really struggles with the issues of the faith and have a hard time finding a place to stand or settle and feel like they're being assaulted, but sometimes don't have the tools to answer back. So for our group, I thought this might fit.
Now, Douglas John Hall, the author of this book, Why Christians, that we're starting with today, is a Canadian. Does his perspective from that part of North America, do you think that adds something special to the way he designed and wrote this book?
You know, I'm not sure, because he went to seminary at Union in New York, and that's clearly a formative experience for him. And American media so blankets Canada that he keeps talking about a North American context. And what he tends to mean is Canada and the United States in a sort of culture that we often share. I would say, though, that there are some differences with his being Canadian. He's a much more courtly writer and speaker when I've heard him lecture than our more relaxed, casual approach in this country. He does make a good number of Canadian references. He loves the Canadian writer George Grant on technological society. He was the first person I saw to reference the wonderful movie Jesus of Montreal. You'll get hints of it, but I think an American would read him and find our country represented with a stark clarity. And maybe because he's over the border, he's able to see us more objectively than sometimes we are ourselves. But by no means would the book seem foreign or distant to anyone reading him, I wouldn't think.
Why should someone use this book to begin to think about apologetics, about making an argument for their particular faith?
I like the book because he follows his old teacher Tillich, that religion, to speak to people, has to speak to a felt and recognized need and issue. And Tillich talked about, in the ancient world, the basic issue was fate and death. And in the Middle Ages, that the basic issue was sin and guilt. But for our time, it's an issue of purpose and meaning. And Hall's young student is struggling at precisely that point. Where can I find meaning in this world? Where can I find purpose or even a sense of vocation in my young life? And what does the Christian faith, how can the Christian faith speak to my situation at this time of my life in a cultural moment that, I think he's right, continues to be one that struggles with issues of purpose and meaning? I don't think it was any accident that Rick Warren's book, Purpose Driven Church or Purpose Driven Life, caught such a chord with so many people, was that he too grabbed on to a question that a lot of us are facing. Another reason I love the book is Hall's aging professor himself takes questions seriously, and that's enormously important to me. When I went to Catholic school and the pre-Vatican 2 days, and I think the nuns were determined to beat questions out of me in order to be accepting of the doctrine of the church and its view of the world. There's folks right here at this church that remember with some bitterness that one of the pastors shut down any questions the young people had at around 13, 14 in their confirmation classes, that this was not a time for questions. And for me, the faith is always about questions, and that's, for me, the broad avenue that we discover and deepen our faith about is through those questions. And if we try to shut them down, the church isn't doing gospel, the church is doing propaganda.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Reverend David Crowley, C-R-O-W-L-E-Y, from Alton, Illinois, by phone. Listeners are encouraged to ask questions, and you may do that by phone. You can call the studio here, and our good technical director, Kyle Crow, will answer the phone and put you online to talk with our guest today, David Crowley. The phone numbers are 333-9455 if you're in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, 217 area code. If it's a long-distance call, do punch in 1-800-222-9455. So those numbers again, 800-222-WILL, or in 217 area code, 333-WILL. 9455. Always eager to have listeners join the conversation. We know many people are just happy to listen, and that's fine too. David, we're talking about a book you recommended to a study group you and I are a part of, Douglas John Hall's Why Christian. This is, of course, the start of Ramadan for our Muslim brothers and sisters. We wish them well as they fast and think and pray and try to develop their own spirituality. What does Douglas John Hall suggest for this young student who's asking all these questions that he does take very seriously? But what does he suggest as a way to find a way to be spiritual in today's culture?
Surprisingly enough, he goes back not to spiritual practices or the sort of cafeteria approach that's so popular now. He really takes the young man back to basics and encourages the young man to start to read the Bible and to actually start to go to church. In other words, basic spiritual formation like the church has normally understood it. It's almost like the story that if one goes to a rabbi and asks, how would I begin to become Jewish? The rabbi will often respond, begin to practice Sabbath. And for Hall, it's begin to learn of the church, to go to church, to learn its source scriptures, but all as a pointer to come to know who Jesus Christ was, is, and is yet to be in this long arcing narrative of history that the church tries to speak of. But at the same time, Hall's one of the things I so admire about him is he considers himself a realist, and he's not projecting the church as anything perfect, and on the contrary, makes clear that it's a most flawed institution. But in the end, it's the Christian message is about reconciliation, and that one of the things we can reconcile ourselves to is that God is fully capable of using a flawed instrument like the church as a provisional demonstration of what human life can be as lived in the way of Jesus Christ. He's careful not to and would speak, I think, very strongly to people right now. He refuses to put the church solely in an institutional frame or box and sees it much more as a way of living and a way of being, and that really to enter church is to be enter into a dialogue not just now, but that one that goes back millennia as people have try to figure out, how do I love God? How do I love neighbor? How do I discover myself? And in so doing, discover those stories reflected in that classic called the Bible.
I remember one of the things I appreciated most of this book, and I had not heard of Douglas John Hall before you introduced us to him. It was a gap in my education, but I really appreciated reading it, but one of the things I liked in this particular book, Why Christian, was when he did talk about the church. He quoted He quoted Augustine, and he said, many whom God has, the church does not have, and many whom the church has, God does not have. In other words, he goes on and says, the identity of what we call Christ Church, who belongs to it, who doesn't, is a mystery known only to God. I thought that was a very important emphasis to make.
Well, yeah, what I love about that is his absolute refusal to allow the Christian church to become an exclusive club that holds in its own hands who's in and who's out in this marvelous and deep word we use of salvation. And that for him, it's just an axiom that if you think you know who's in and who's out, that's almost a guarantee that you're wrong. And so many people right now are so concerned that the church takes on this mantle of saying who's in and who's out, who especially who has a ticket to heaven. I was just appalled just today that a minister in Colorado boldly declared that only the Christians who were killed in the massacre in Aurora were going to heaven, but not the non-Christians. And he proceeded to find opponents to blame for that horrific act. And I have a member here who's just fixated on the idea that can the church say definitively that those who are not Christians somehow have lost their way, and that those who are Christian have somehow the capacity to absorb this deep and varied faith and make what we read in church today, creating a wall of hostility between one group and another, even within that church. Yeah, and he just won't permit that. He, as I said, it's a remarkably realistic but also critical view of the institution while supporting its often faulty, often partial groping toward the truth that the church in the end claims not in a doctrine but in a person.
We're talking on Keeping the Faith today with Reverend David Crowley from Alton, Illinois, where he's a designated pastor in a congregation there, about a book by Douglas John Hall, Why Christian? It's for those on the edge of faith. Another thing I liked in this book of Hall's was his focus on, I guess, action or values, saying that what really matters is what your faith leads you to do. And in terms of being concerned for the poor, being concerned for justice, being concerned for those kind of issues, he says religion is always about power. Faith, on the contrary, is about love, and therefore weakness. Yes, weakness. And he talks about living for others, serving others, being vulnerable. What a wonderful change.
Yeah, and you've really, I think, put your finger on one of the key elements of his thought throughout his career. In the late 70s, he wrote two books on stewardship, which is this horribly overused Christian word that I don't know speaks well to people anymore. But Hall continues Tillich's project. How do I hold on to the values of the Christian faith throughout time, but using them in or translating those into words and values or actions, as you just said, that make sense what in our time, in our particular context? He won't let love be merely a Hallmark card word, nor will he permit love to be this giant abstraction that we march under. But as you said, it has to be the coalescing of action and value. And in picking love, he really fires his most direct shot at the doctrine of the church and the church's doctrine of God by refusing to let God's power be power over people or an imperial power, but he always translates God's love as the power of love, or perhaps we could call it empowering love. And that is a position he returns to over and over and over again. So in an odd sort of way, he is somewhat pleased that the church itself now lives on the edge of faith, because that's pushing the church away from its pretensions to power and its reliance on social or economic or even spiritual power, and it's going to force us, he hopes, into again having the church be the agent of this empowering love, this active love, and in so doing find our bearings more clearly than we have when we've been so allied to social and political power all these years.
Douglas John Hall's book that we're discussing, Why Christian, is published by Fortress Press. It's available, of course, anywhere you can buy books. David Crowley, tell us what other books you'd recommend of Douglas John Hall for people who have been intrigued by what you've said so far about this book.
Oh, my goodness. My desk here in the office is littered with Hall books. I've always been, ever since I started thinking seriously about religion, I've always been interested in the issue of theodicy, which is the 50-cent word for the issue of God and human suffering, or as it's usually put, how can a God who's called powerful, but how can a God who's also called good and loving then preside over a world that's filled with so much pain, suffering, and evil? And so one of my first introductions to Hall was a book on theodicy that he wrote called God and Human Suffering that Augsburg put out in the mid-80s. And so that would be one off that I would mention immediately. I'm happy to talk about that one for a while, or if you want me to rattle off some more books, we can do it that way too, Steve.
Well, I think with the Aurora, Colorado shooting, let's talk about God and human suffering. What approach does Hall take to that?
He tries to recover, going all the way back to Luther, what Luther called the theology of the cross. And for Hall, he thinks that the church has made a decided mistake in that we fell into the trap Luther called the theology of glory, which is a sort of conquering, powerful, triumphant theology. And for him, no, that the point of the Christian exercise in the end is that we find that God, to sound like Moltmann for a moment, is never more divine than at the cross, or that it's only through the darkness, through the activity of the cross, that we discover Emmanuel, God with us, not in those mountaintop experiences only, but in the depths of the human soul at those 3 o'clock in the morning times, or in this parade of horrors that we're willing to put up with year after year, like in Aurora, Colorado. So that for him, the talk about Jesus Christ as God incarnate, or Emmanuel, God with us, means that God is with us all the way down, including the hells we often make on earth, or the hell that apparently this mentally ill young man is already living in. Apparently he believes that he sees himself in a movie. That'd be the kind of demon that Jesus exorcised people of. And that, in that sense, for him, these kind of events aren't judgments or punishments at the hand of a god who's like Zeus, but very much more so a god who is almost brought caught up into a tragic structure of creation across the board because God made this seemingly ineluctable decision. Once God gave room for a world to exist, God took the immense risk of things going awry. That love that allows all to exist, that structures everything to exist, bears much pain, and that's built into it. And so for him, the way through is from within these experiences of pain, and that it's impossible for us to just promise pie in the sky by and by as if that will make everything better. But we can look toward a future with hope where we see less of this, or we struggle to redeem it as best we can. But he stands foursquare against the church's temptation to deny evil in the world, or to try to explain it or excuse it as a demonstration of God's will or God's power. And again, this an earlier book he did on the theology of the cross was called Light in Our Darkness, and this is a continuation of that thought about 10 years later, and it's never really left him, I don't think.
We're talking with David Crowley from Alton, Illinois, about the Christian theologian and author Douglas John Hall. The two books David just was referring to was God and Human Suffering, and before that, Lights in Our Darkness. We're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program this afternoon. Let me just quickly mention the full names of a couple theologians that David has referred to by their last names. Moltmann is Jürgen Moltmann, that's spelled with a J, the German style, Jürgen Moltmann, and Paul Tillich, who was for many years at the University of Chicago, two great minds of the previous century. And now we're talking about Douglas John Hall, who is a professor emeritus from Montreal, wasn't it? McGill.
Yes, he was at McGill University in Montreal.
At
that's
McGill.
Right. Yeah. Let me give you as we were talking about the theology of the cross. This is out of the Why Christian book we mentioned.
Sure.
And Paul says, in the cross of Jesus, that cross not only demonstrates the lengths to which God is ready to go in God's loving search for lost and alienated humanity, it also represents the grim extent of our human capacity to reject love when it is offered us. But it is precisely in this altogether honest confrontation of God and estranged humanity that real love begins to be learned. And then he repeats it. I said, begins. Let's not exaggerate that. If we do, we'll just end up with sentimentality again. No love, even human love, is perfect. But our loves are only pale approximations at best of God's suffering love. Christians, more than anybody else, should know this. Because the sin that we supposedly confess daily or weekly in church is our perennial failure to love as we are loved. And that gives you a sense of the direction he tends to follow, I think.
That was a reading from Why Christian by Douglas John Hall, read by David Crowley, our guest today on Keeping the Faith. Let me give the phone numbers again for listeners who would like to join this conversation. 333-9455 in the 217 area code, close to our station here in Urbana, Illinois. If you're farther away and it's a long-distance call, punch in 1-800-222-9455. Happy to have you ask questions or make comments. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these programs. Coming up next week, I'll be talking with an author, William Young, about his new book, a baseball biography, about a Native American, an American Indian baseball player named John Tortoise Myers. He was referred to as Chief Myers during his playing time. And he was very proud of his Native American heritage, became a tribal leader after his major league career. We'll be asking William Young, the author, why, as a religious studies professor in Missouri, he chose to write a book about a baseball player. That'll be next week on Keeping the Faith, July 29. On August 5th, we'll be talking with a recent graduate of the University of Illinois, Sean Denny, about his part designing and building the University of Illinois entry in the Solar Decathlon competition for building a house that's very, I'm blanking on the words for it, but uses energy very efficiently. That'll be August 5th, talking about the Solar Decathlon house built by the University of Illinois. It's back on this campus, by the way. It can be visited soon. August 12th, our guest will be some people from the Protestant for the Common Good and talking about public policy advocacy, Lauren Dean Friedrich and Courtney Eccles. Michael Trout will be our guest on August 19th, talking about a CD he helped write and produce called The Hope-Filled Parent, Meditations of Foster and Adoptive Parents on Children who have been Harmed. That Michael Trout will be our guest on August 19th. Well, we do have a caller waiting to join our conversation with David Crowley. Line number one. Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hello. I was wondering, since we all are going to live in this world at some point in our lives, it seems to me that everyone will suffer somehow. So I don't believe that God sends suffering. He may help us get through it, but I don't think he sends it. I don't think it's a punishment. I think it's an experience because we're human. That was it. That was all I called to say.
Well, thank you. I couldn't agree with you more.
Oh, thank you. I was a little nervous.
Oh no, but I think that a substantial proportion of Christians are fed that line, and in an almost desperate attempt to try to keep people in line by under certain dogmatic strictures, we still produce that. Or let me put it another way, that even if you and I agree completely, when we suffer, I think sometimes in the back of our minds arises a question, did I do something to deserve this? Am I being punished for something? And I hear examples of that when I'm sitting in a funeral home visitation a lot, and people will say things like, well, God must have needed your loved one, or God never gives us more than we can carry, and a whole series of things that carry with it the connotation that God is, in fact, inflicting suffering on us rather directly.
And you don't agree with that at all.
That would be exactly right. Yeah, I could not agree with the caller more that we live in a world that's tragically structured. And indeed, perhaps if you want to use language like testing, that our response to suffering and our reaction to it is often where our character's crucible is discovered. In some very real ways. But for me, instead of trying to defend God on the issue of suffering, I'm very much influenced by somebody, say, like Wendy Farley, who just reminds us that, yes, granted, the world's is tragically structured often, but when we can, it's the Christian duty to seek healing for those who suffer or to seek justice in the structures that permit a lot of suffering to occur. But I think both directly and subconsciously, this ancient mythic fear of a God that continues to hurl thunderbolts is often present for us.
Could I say one more thing?
Sure. Of course.
I also don't think that Christians are the only people who can express love. I was in an accident about 30 years ago, and the person who took me to the hospital was Muslim, and he waited for 4 hours with me, and he didn't even know me.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I've got to say.
Well, thank you. And again, I'm with you completely. I would say that Christian love is always measured by the example of Jesus Christ, but in that sense, we see that example in people who hold the name of Christian or not. And in a way, given our current circumstances, you've just given us a replay of the story of the Good Samaritan, except we could call it the good Islamic follower. And again, we live in a time where some of brothers and sisters in the Christian faith are determined to draw, again, I going back to that Ephesians line we read in church today, the dividing wall of hostility between Islam and Christianity. But that goes on to speak about Christ really as almost the keystone of an arch that unites people. And you just gave a great example of compassion in action and love in action, the way Hall would insist that we hold to.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. And others may join us by punching in 333-9455 or long distance 1-800-222-9455. David Crowley, let's leave Douglas John Hall. We've talked about him. You just mentioned Wendy Farley. What do you like about that contemporary feminist theologian?
Well, different than her father, Edward, I can actually read her and understand at least two sentences in order. So that's the first point. She's had a remarkably interesting biography. Like I said, the first book I'm aware of is this Tragic Divine Compassion and Tragic Vision, or vice versa. I can't remember the exact title. And I love the idea of her contribution to the theodicy idea that this doesn't have to be passive reflection and intellectualizing about suffering, but that Christians are called actively to heal and actively establish justice to fight the causes of suffering where we see it. I'm always reminded now, in fact, through her, when I read the Gospels, when Jesus encounters suffering people, he doesn't blame them. He doesn't tell them to go to a different source. He heals them, and that he himself, in the end, dies on this journey of offering love, compassionate love, active love to those whom he meets in his sadly foreshortened life. She had a crisis then. I believe she had a marital crisis, which then turned out to be that evidenced in hysterical blindness, which makes it tough when you're an academician to be able to write. But she wrote a remarkable book, even with her eyesight having failed. And in so doing, she almost sounded like your caller, where she found some solace in Buddhist traditions and started to try to weave some Buddhist traditions and its reaction and response to suffering with her Christian beliefs, because in the end she is a Christian theologian. She has a wonderful new book that's just out that she calls The Theology of the Incarnation, called Gathering Those Who Are Driven Away, and is a remarkable attempt, at least in my view, to emphasize the incarnation as God's attempt to continue to call those not only on the edges of faith, but on the edges of society, and that they indeed may be our best teachers into some of the things we struggle with. So for an academic theologian, it's a remarkable book, because she'll quote folk songs and regular songs and academic books and sermons all in this sort of wonderful bouillabaisse that she's created, that's really a different style of writing theology. She's quite remarkable. She still teaches at Emory, I believe.
This is Wendy Farley we're talking about with David Crowley. And David, we have another caller, this time on line number 4, our long-distance line. Go ahead, caller.
Yes, your statement really spoke to me about, I believe, religion was about power and faith was about love. And I guess the concern I have is it seems to me those in an institutional setting in the Christian church, Christian churches don't help us to deal with our own humanity very well. And it seems like, especially in the more conservative ones, in the area of human sexuality and in dealing with anger and real emotions, maybe conflict, it seems like so often there's kind of a squelch and a rather rigid role that persons are formed into. Your reaction?
Oh, boy. So much of me agrees with you completely that so often the church fails in what you put very nicely. How do we face the human struggles that we all have, be it a fundamental matter of identity like sexuality, or, again, something that we all share? How do we deal with our anger? And I'm with you that so often what we've done is shaken our finger at people and said no, or don't do that, or just say no. And instead, it seems to me that the church at its best helps us to know when to say no and when to say yes. And part of me sees that is that the church has gotten unmoored from its source, interestingly enough, the scriptures. As I've been saying, we're on the book of Ephesians in what's called a lectionary, which is a set of readings in a lot of mainstream Protestant or formerly mainline Protestant churches. And it quotes Psalm 4 and says, "Be angry, but do not sin." And I couldn't agree with you more that the church, one of the church's struggles is how to help us accept and recognize human successes and human failings, but also what are practices and devices where theory and practice come together mm-hmm. and can help us deal with these very basic emotions, whether they're guilt or shame or anger, or how do I view my core self in terms of sexuality, but again, within this framework that the church often has, which is in the end the gospel of Jesus Christ. But at the same time, I'm so afraid that we've gotten so quick in this new century to just denigrate institutional religion. And it seems to me that people are not only individuals, but that we're bound together. And in the end, religion means to tie together, to bind together. We're all in the same boat. And instead of telling people to reinvent the wheel or to find their own path, I think the church at its best offers us some pathways that have been long trod to help us through these things that we all share as human beings. But I really want to reiterate, I think across the board, whether it's liberal or conservative churches, depending on our own vantage point, we've far, far too often said no and haven't given people a clue how to say yes to what the gospel calls the new life in Jesus Christ.
I come from a Mennonite background, and one of the church periodicals had quoted a psychiatrist in Edmonton, Alberta, who I thought made a very perceptive remark, and I'll close with this. He said, "The church is not a very good place to reveal yourself. You're depressed, you're sad, you're down, you're not hopeful." And I think you've just spoken to that. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. David, you're still there?
Yes, sir.
What do you think? Is it dangerous to reveal yourself in a religious organization if you have problems?
Oh, boy, Steve, yes and no. One of the things that both gives me hope and saddens me is that, as our caller said, that the church is a very difficult place to reveal yourself because one feels you have to put on the mask of piety. But in church basements all over this land are AA groups that is in some ways a secularized form of worship, which is the only place where struggling people can feel like they can reveal themselves. On the other hand, the church, I think, is one of the few places where you can tell the truth about yourself, and it's there in the ritual of confession and the declaration of pardon. It might be the only place in this success-drenched culture we have where we can stand up together and alone in the quiet of our hearts and say that we fall short and that we've failed and that we struggle with these very human problems. And the entire movement of the church toward pastoral care and counseling, for me, is another way the church has done this magnificently, where it's the one place where people can talk about their faith struggles and their value struggles at the same time they're dealing with emotional or cognitive issues and try to do what salvation is all about, or at least touch a piece of it, which is to become a whole and integrated personality. So again, I mean, we have so much that we have and can continue to offer, but I must say, especially as a pastor, this is very true, where folks in the church, rightly or wrongly, want to put the pastor on a pedestal. And even in the best of support groups for pastors, it is very difficult to be willing or even able to reveal one's struggles and one's doubts. And you see it in just the ridiculous amount of burnout and folks who leave the organized clergy year by year because they haven't found it in the very place that one would hope they could.
We're down to about our last 8 minutes with David Crowley, speaking with him by phone from Altson, Illinois, where he's a designated pastor in a congregation there. He taught political science for many years. He has degrees from the University of North Carolina, from the University of Maryland, and then went to Princeton Seminary, where he graduated. We're talking with him about various books, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Let me just mention that if you missed part of this program and would like to hear it later at your convenience online, you may go to will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. Just leave the G off of keeping, and you'll find that all of our programs, past programs, pop up, and you can listen on your electronic device at your leisure. This, of course, is also heard live on WILL AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD3. David, tell us about some other books you've been reading, and I won't even hold you to making you talk about Christian theology. What else have you had that's interesting or fun?
Let's see. Well, I was really disappointed in the new Bruce Springsteen book by a professor named Dolan. It's, if you want to know where he sang different songs over the years in concert, it's pretty good. But I was, I guess, hoping for a book that would look really carefully at the development of his music and his wonderful lyrics over the years, and I found that sort of wanting. But you're dealing with someone who has quoted Bruce Springsteen in benedictions and in countless sermons, so the guy had a hard act to follow. Probably the thing I've kept with political science as much as anything is I continue to be fascinated with the founding period of the United States, especially the constitutional period. And I've been reading a wonderful new biography on James Madison by a guy named Gutzman that would be particularly good for people who don't know that much about it and need someone to walk them nice and slowly through not only the debates around the Constitution and before it, but the ratification debates then after it. And for all those folks who believe they can discover the original intention of the Constitution, then one finds that you get into quite the thicket in trying to figure out, well, of whom are we speaking that holds this original intention? Because it may well be different in Madison's mind or another framer's mind or in the people who ended up writing the Constitution. Let's see, what else have I been looking at? There's a book called 381 AD that I like a lot. It's a church history book by a guy named Charles Freeman, and it really takes us all the way back to the era of the Nicene Creed in 325, and then its addition that adds the Holy Spirit material in 381. But the remarkable part of the book is he really traces the church's desire to say no to anything that was considered unorthodox, or that the place where you could see the church starting to say no to questions begin in this period, because, as Hall would tell you, this is where church and state get fused. And so Emperor Theodosius starts to use church disputes is a way to try and exercise his untrammeled political authority as well. And so when we fuse those two elements of church and state, now the church, instead of being a variegated institution and groups where a thousand flowers would bloom, starts to try to look like a monarchy in the faith, and starts to have this repressive element that so many people seem to continue to apply to the church as an institution. And so it's a remarkable thing that the grist for people's current anti-institutional bias toward the church or religion has its roots almost as far back as the church itself can reach. And that's a little disquieting in that I go to a church where we read the Nicene Creed rather regularly as part of our worship, and to see it as part of a political emphasis on power over others for an emperor is more than a little disquieting for me.
That again was the book 381.
It's called AD 381 by Charles Freeman. Yeah.
Thank you.
He has another book that a lot of people like called The Closing of the Western Mind that a lot of people have liked.
What about reading for fun?
That's sort of reading for fun.
For you as a political science person, sure.
Yeah, well, really for me, reading a history book or a science book is reading for fun, yeah. What was the last science book I read? It's by a guy named Tattersall, and it's called Masters of the Planet. And it's one of the clearest looks at the evolution of the human species, not only when we started to split off from the ape ancestors, but a really careful look at the physical and mental developments that allow us to start to become recognizably human. And then with that, one of the best DVDs I finally saw the movie Cave of Forgotten Dreams that Werner Herzog did, where it looks at the earliest cave paintings from 30-some thousand years ago and has this striking image of an artist with a broken little finger who has traced his hand on a cave rock. And I'm convinced it wasn't just his way of doing a signature, but that he was trying to reach the world beyond. And the way he symbolized it was drawing his hand in that cave, where in all likelihood they had rituals and dreams of human beings trying to reach the world beyond and face those questions of life and death and power as far back as any of us can even imagine.
I've been reading some older books, fiction. Fiction is what I love most, I guess. Do you read any Any fiction, new or old?
Not that much. One of the few mystery or detective books, I loved the old series of detective books by the late Robert Parker, and his estate has continued a series like the Jesse Stone series or the famous Spencer series. And I just read the new one of that by an author who has taken on his mantle called Lullaby, and it was quite wonderful to see these old characters come to life, even though their creator has died after writing so many of the books. And it was like meeting an old friend again after you thought that the door had long been closed. That, I really enjoyed that.
Poetry? Do you read any poetry?
Oh, the main poet that I read is this brilliant poet named Steve Shoemaker.
We need to stop, pull you off right there, sorry.
And, you know, occasionally I'll just, you know, read, I do read, I had a professor of pastoral care, Daniel Capps at Princeton, and he introduced me to poets like Mary Oliver and Denise Levertov, and Wendell Berry, who writes also novels that I love in his fictional place of Port William in Kentucky. And so, and I so admire it for their power of images, because the bad thing about being a minister is you're always thinking, how can I use this in a Bible study or a sermon? And the power that poets have in being able to take an image and turn it to the light, and you can see its different facets, is for me really productive when I'm struggling with words for sermons or trying to give a different angle on something. So I'm not the biggest poetry reader, but those are some of the folks I'll look at on occasion.
We are out of time, and I want to thank our guest today, David Crowley, for taking an hour on a Sunday when I know he's probably exhausted from his work in Alton at the Presbyterian Church there as the designated pastor, for talking with us about books. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Steve. This was fun.
Next week on Keeping the Faith, I'll be talking with William Young, the author of a brand new book, a baseball biography about Chief Myers, a Native American baseball player from back in the early times of the 20th century. We'll be talking with him by phone. He's a religious studies scholar who's written a book on baseball. Following that, August 5th, the Solar Decathlon House, one of the recent University of Illinois graduates who worked on that house, Sean Denny, will be our guest here on Keeping the Faith. On August 12th, we'll be talking with two people from the Community Renewal Society and the Protestants for the Common Good about advocating for public policy based on values. Michael Trout will be our guest August 9th, talking about the hope-filled parent. He wrote some poetry, some meditations, a CD of foster and adoptive parents on children who have been harmed. I'm Steve Shoemaker. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Swires Land and Management Company, Danville; EAGCO Incorporated, Fairmount; Springfield Electric, Springfield; and Cannon Farms, Camargo. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Illinois Public Media.